If you want to buy a gun in Illinois, you need to get a background check, but you don't have to submit fingerprints. The Cook County Sheriff's Office says it's time to change that. Plus, nursing homes around the state have been closing for financial reasons, and advocates say it's going to get worse. And you may know Fermilab for its cutting-edge physics research, but they also keep up to 30 bison you can visit, and the first calf of the year was born just this weekend.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, why nursing homes across Illinois have been shutting down, including three so far just this year. In a moment, we'll also dig into the process for legally buying a gun. The Cook County Sheriff's Office says it's long past time to require fingerprinting for everyone who wants to purchase a gun. Also, in the springtime, we know lots of farm animal babies are born. That's also true for the bisons at Fermilab. But first, this morning, WBEZ Chicago was reporting that federal law enforcement officials are investigating Governor J.B. Pritzker, First Lady M.K. Pritzker, and his brother-in-law, Thomas Munster. It goes back to a story that was raised during Governor Pritzker's run for office, property tax breaks. If you recall, the Pritzkers received a property tax break of more than $331,000 on a Gold Coast mansion by having the toilets removed and the house declared uninhabitable. WBEZ is reporting this morning from a law enforcement source that the federal probe began in October. Charges are not imminent, WBEZ has said. We have reached out to the governor's office for comment. He's actually scheduled to speak with reporters this morning, so hopefully we'll be able to bring that to you later this hour. WBEZ did speak with an attorney for the Pritzkers who told WBEZ, quote, neither the governor nor the first lady have been contacted by law enforcement regarding the property tax appeal. He added, we're confident that any further review of the matter will show that the appropriate rules were followed. The Pritzkers have not been accused of any wrongdoing and no charges have been filed. We'll continue following the story this hour and tomorrow. More than 2 million people in Illinois currently have FOID cards. That's a firearm owner's identification card. And to legally own a gun in Illinois, those 2 million people all had to get a background check. But you might be surprised to know that the process does not include fingerprints. FOID cards have gotten much more attention over the past few months. Back in February, a man named Gary Martin shot and killed five co-workers at the Henry Pratt Company in Aurora. Martin first applied for and received a FOID card in 2014, despite having a felony conviction on his record for aggravated assault in Mississippi. But officials didn't know about that felony conviction until he applied for an expedited concealed carry permit and submitted fingerprints. That turned up the out-of-state felony. But by then, Martin had already bought weapons, and Illinois State Police did not confiscate them. Now, a new bill would change gun ownership laws and make fingerprinting mandatory for a FOID card. Kate Rosenberg Douglas is on the line with us now. She's been reporting on this from the Chicago Tribune newsroom, where she's with us, joining us now. Also with us is Kara Smith. She's a chief policy officer for Cook County Sheriff's Office. Kate, Kara, thank you for being with us. Welcome back to the 21st.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Kara, I wonder if we can just start with you and just explain for people who aren't familiar. I mentioned a few of the details of the process of obtaining a FOID card, but can you just walk us through all the steps of what it takes to get a firearm owner identification card?
Sure. It's a process that is run by the Illinois State Police, and the law contains several criteria that would disqualify a person from obtaining a FOID card. Felony criminal history, orders of protection, drug addiction, et cetera. And the process is fairly straightforward, that you complete your application and submit it to the state police. It's then processed and returned to, that the card is provided to the applicant, provided there was no disqualifying events that were discovered in the application process.
Kara, what's the difference between that and a concealed carry license? Is that then, for that sounds like when you apply for a concealed carry license or permit, then there's even further information that's required?
Yes, there is. And with the exception of Illinois, the other states in the nation have one of two forms of concealed carry processes. One is called, referred to commonly as the May issue process. And in those states, a person applies and law enforcement has discretion whether to issue the application or issue the license or not. Other states, and the majority of states, have what's called a shall issue, meaning if you meet the criteria set forth in that state's law, you receive your concealed carry license. Illinois has somewhat of a hybrid where the law sets forth criteria for obtaining a concealed carry license, a certain number of firearm training hours, you can't have certain arrests or convictions. But then also law enforcement in Illinois has the ability to object. So in Cook County, the sheriff takes that responsibility very seriously, and every single applicant for a concealed carry license in Cook County outside of the city of Chicago, because Chicago does their own objections, we review those applicants to see if there's anything that might raise a concern. For instance, perhaps we've had mental health incidents with that individual, or they've had arrests that are concerning to our office. So we will put forth an objection to that applicant, and then there's a concealed carry licensing board that evaluates whether or not an objection from law enforcement will prevent the license from being issued. The majority of objections are overruled, but that's what the process, very generally what the process looks like in for the concealed carry license.
Kara, when you mentioned that you all, the Cook County Sheriff's Office, takes this very seriously, I imagine this is something that every police department takes seriously, but probably I want to think about smaller police departments throughout the state. Do you think there are enough resources within across Illinois for police departments to be able to do the type of investigations that are required?
I think there's not even close to the resources that are necessary to have the process be as effective as I think the General Assembly intended it to be. And I by no means mean to suggest that other law enforcement don't take it seriously, but the objection process is a very time-consuming endeavor, and many departments do not have, you know, the resources to be able to devote to it. But, you know, to me, there's two buckets of areas of great concern for law enforcement and for the public, and that is tight controls on who is authorized to purchase a firearm and then carry it on their person. And secondly, when a person falls out of compliance, when a person becomes revoked, we need an airtight process to be able to, number one, recover the FOID card, because even a revoked FOID card can be used to purchase ammunition. And second, to make sure that we do not have guns in the hands of people who state and federal law said shouldn't have them.
That's Kara Smith with Cook County Sheriff's Office. Kate Rosenberg Douglas is also with us with the Chicago Tribune. And Kate, to Kara's point, I referenced the really tragic incident with Gary Martin at the beginning of this conversation. Can you remind us what happened with his CCL, his concealed carry license application, as well as his FOID card?
Yes, definitely. In Gary Martin's case, he had a felony in his background from out of state, from Mississippi, and because of some cracks in the national background reporting system, they conducted a background check, but he was able to get his FOID card. In his case, he then, when he wanted to get his concealed carry license, you do not have to submit fingerprints for that. So, but you can, if you want an expedited processing, if you want the Illinois State Police to do that within 90 days. So to do that, then you do need to submit fingerprints. So it is optional, but he decided to submit fingerprints. And it was at that point that that officials, you know, were able to find out about the felony in his background. And so they did not give him a concealed carry license. And at that point would have sent out a letter to local law enforcement saying that he should turn in his FOID card as well, which, you know, as far as we know, he did not do.
And then also the other part of this, though, Kate, when it comes to Gary Martin, why did his background check, do we know why the felony conviction never came up when he did his background check for the FOID card?
As far as I know, there hasn't been a clear answer on that. But in speaking with Cara and some others, it seems like this is something that happens because there's some strengthening that needs to go on to the national system, where some states either are not submitting the information in a timely manner or at all. And so it's something that people are calling for, some strengthening of.
Cara, I mean, I wonder, I think there might be people who are concerned to hear. I mean, this incident, of course, brought this to light, I think, a little bit more than maybe people who are not in law enforcement or aware of. But is that often sometimes or perhaps the case that someone applies for a background check? I think logically you would think that would be a background check that would happen all across the country.
Right. And that absolutely is a reasonable thing to assume. And it should be a fact. But it depends on, you know, how thorough the data reporting systems are in every single state in the nation. And I don't have information about the question you asked, Kate, about why it didn't pop, that conviction didn't pop up when they did the background check in Gary Martin's case. But we have had other cases, you know, where another state just hadn't uploaded the conviction information in a timely way. So it's a patchwork for sure. And the good news, to the extent there is any, is that there's good legislation that's pending that will hopefully bring some, you know, long overdue, very common sense provisions into Illinois law that will take us closer to a safe process when we're granting someone the ability to purchase a gun in Illinois and to carry it on their person.
Can you tell us about House Bill 96, how that would change the current process for fingerprinting, what, to Cara's point, about what's being proposed now?
Sure. There are a number of things that it would do. And, of course, the big one is requiring fingerprints. And that's something not just at the concealed carry level. You mentioned earlier, you think, you know, people might be surprised to even learn that fingerprints aren't required. They're not just not required for the concealed carry. It's optional for that. And they're not required for even the FOID card. So it would require, House Bill 96 would require FOID applicants to submit their fingerprints as part of their application. They also want to have these applications processed in person. They think that would also kind of close some of these loopholes in terms of people using fake or false identities. It would require a background check for all gun sales, including those by a private seller. That's not currently a requirement for the private sales. It would, again, as I said, require them to go in person. The state police have 22 districts around the state, and you would need to get to one of those 22 districts to make your in-person application with fingerprints.
And Kate, I wonder, as we're thinking about all of these things, what you're hearing from different gun rights advocacy groups, gun rights groups about this. I know you spoke to Illinois Carry. What are you hearing from people who oppose this legislation as to why they oppose it?
You know, the basic thing that I hear over and over and over is that this is a constitutionally protected right, and you can't put any restrictions on a constitutionally provided right. And that's something that I think people have been, you know, disagreeing about forever. David Lombardo is a CCL instructor. He's the owner of Safer USA. He's told me he thinks that requiring fingerprints is a slippery slope. Today it's fingerprinting, tomorrow it's something else. He's also said you can't put restrictions on a constitutionally protected right. He and I disagree on that. And I brought up, you know, you have to pass a test and pay a fee to get your driver's license. Or if you want, you know, TSA pre-check or universal entry, you have to go to O'Hare and do an in-person interview and pay a big fee. But he feels that guns are different because of the Second Amendment. The right to bear arms is listed in the Constitution. And I think that's kind of the endless debate that people, you know, have been fighting about forever.
Point, Kara, I wonder, we're almost out of time. We have about a minute left, though, and I just wanted to ask, you know, you're with Cook County Sheriff's Office, what you would say, especially to thinking about people who are listening to this outside of Chicago, to who might say, oh, this is just something that the Chicago area is trying to force on the rest of the state. What would you say in response to that?
You know, I have two quick responses, and I'm grateful to be part of this conversation. But the first is that when someone becomes revoked under federal and state law, every single person in the state should be concerned that the process we have in place can be effective. Because I think that's one place where both sides agree, when someone is determined to be unfit or disqualified from having possessing a gun or being able to carry it, we need to fix that process and we need to do it quickly. And there's going to be some resources necessary. And
Kara, I'm afraid we're out of time, but you know what? If you want to just hold on and you can finish that thought on the other side of this break, do you mind just sticking around for a minute? And then you can, I know this is an important answer and I want to give you the time to answer that. Can you hold on for a minute for this? Okay, thanks. All right. So we just have to take a short break here. We'll pick up this conversation on the other side of that. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're just now talking about House Bill 96 that would change the current process for a FOID card, a firearm identification card, to require fingerprinting. We've been talking about that with Kate Rosenberg Douglas from the Chicago Tribune. Kara Smith, the Chief Policy Officer for Cook County Sheriff's Office, has also been with us. Kara, I just wanted you to finish that thought before the break in terms of what you would say in response to folks who are saying this is a limit on Second Amendment rights. You were saying that, you know, anyone who has their FOID card revoked, this is a federal matter that everyone needs to take seriously. But there was the second part of that you wanted to add as well.
Yeah, I think we have some very important pieces of and very thoughtful pieces of legislation that are pending. And I think that, you know, during the legislative process, I'm very hopeful that some of the key, you know, most important provisions that will help us strengthen the law in ways to protect people when people become revoked will pass. You know, unfortunately, I think that oftentimes, you know, the gun rights lobby, you know, sort of banks on, you know, memories fading. And I'm very, very hopeful that in this case, the tragedy that occurred in Aurora will finally propel some action here and we'll get some common sense strengthening in both the application process as well as what we do when a person becomes revoked.
That's Kara Smith with the Cook County Sheriff's Office. I want to thank her as well as Kate Rosenberg Douglas for joining us. We'll tweet out Kate's story so you can see her reporting on House Bill 96. Both of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Yesterday, we heard about some work being done to care for our youngest residents who have experienced deep trauma in their lives. Today, we wanted to focus on our oldest residents across Illinois, and that's specifically talking about nursing homes, which have been in big trouble for a while thanks to less and less money from the state of Illinois. 20 have closed in the last 5 years. 3 have already closed in 2019, and it gets worse for our most vulnerable seniors. For every patient on Medicaid, nursing homes lose an average of $41 a day. Given all that, and given the fact that Illinois' aging population is growing, what can we do about this? For more on this, I'm joined by Pat Comstock, Executive Director of the Healthcare Council of Illinois, a nursing home advocacy group. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the 21st. Pat, are you there? We've also got Jerry Nowicki with us. He reported on this for Capital News Illinois. Jerry, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. How are you?
Good. Well, we're working on getting Pat on the air with us. Jerry, can you just start, though, by laying out where this is happening and who's affected when we're thinking about how many nursing homes are closing every year and where they are?
Yeah, a lot of them are in small communities, and it's because the Medicaid rate, the reimbursement rate for these homes is at decades-old numbers. And so these are safety nets for the older people that need greater care. And just there's been countless communities across the state that have been affected by it.
Pat Comstock is with us now. Hi, Pat, can you hear us now?
I can, thank you.
Sure. So when we're thinking about these numbers that have closed, are there more that are on the verge of closing or maybe just hanging on by a thread?
Every facility, every nursing home in Illinois that cares for a high number of Medicaid residents is struggling.
And when there's,
we see those numbers increasing every day.
And when you say they're struggling, how much of this is because of Medicaid and the reimbursement rate, Pat?
The Medicaid reimbursement rate in Illinois, it does in no way comes close to covering the cost of the care that these residents need. You know, I think a lot of times people think of nursing homes as the old age home of the past, where, you know, we see our grandmother knitting in the corner, and those buildings are long gone. These are seniors with highly complex medical needs, and the rates simply have not kept up with the care needs of the residents as times have changed.
Jerry, I wonder if we can think about, when we're talking specifically about Medicaid reimbursement rates, Illinois, correct me if I'm wrong, is second worst in the country when it comes to reimbursement rates, Jerry?
Yes, that's what the report said.
And why, do we know why our state does such a poor job on this?
So the reimbursement rates are, there's support, nursing, and capital, which relies on property taxes, and those bills are the bills they use to determine those are from, I think, 2014, 2004, and 1999, respectively. So the property tax bills are 20 years old that they're using to determine the capital cost reimbursements. So everyone knows that property taxes have been going up for one reason or another and for several years. And relying on those old numbers just doesn't jibe well with, you know, keeping these homes afloat.
And Jerry, how does that get changed? Is that the responsibility of the state legislature, or how do those get determined?
Yeah, the state determines their reimbursement rates, and then the federal government matches that 100% in most cases. I think Pat might be able to go into that a little bit more depth, but the amount the state reimburses will be matched by federal government.
Pat, when we're thinking about these reimbursement rates, Pat, how long do nursing homes have to wait to get payments from the state, regardless of the size of those payments?
The state can be 90 to 120 days behind, but that's not the issue. A lot of our buildings have now transition to managed care, and managed care organizations are severely behind in paying. But those are just cash flow issues. That issue doesn't address the systemic structural problems in the rate. Jerry did a good job, not only in his story, but in his statement just now, of outlining how far behind the baseline years of our reimbursement rates are. we're getting, based on the property tax area, we're getting reimbursed based upon a 1997 tax bill. Everybody knows that their real estate taxes are not the same as they were in 1997. So that factor alone should illustrate to people how far behind the calculations of our rates really are.
Mm-hmm. That's Pat Comstock from the Healthcare Council of Illinois, a nursing home advocacy group. We've also been speaking with Jerry Nowecki, a reporter for Capital News Illinois. We'll tweet out Jerry's stories that he's been doing about nursing homes that are closing all over the state. Obviously, there are lots of reasons why this is happening, as we've been talking about. But I wanted to introduce someone else into this conversation. Steve Dean is the mayor of Leroy, a town of about 3,500 people. It's roughly about 20 minutes southeast of Bloomington Normal. Hi, Mayor Dean. Welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about Leroy Manor. I know it just closed just this year. How long was this facility in your town?
Leroy Manor was here for at least 30 years on the planning board, on the planning table, and in operation for a good 25. And it was kind of the lifeblood for the senior population here in town, because it allowed our residents to stay local when they needed to move into a facility, either as a resident or for physical therapy, or into the Alzheimer's unit. It was a real blow to the town when we lost the manor.
Why did it close?
Money issues, reimbursement issues, bed population, just private pays just did not begin to cover the daily expenses of keeping the doors open for a 24-hour, you know, full-service facility.
And so, Mayor Dean, correct me if I'm wrong, there were about 66 residents and about 75 employees working at Leroy Manor. Is that correct?
That's close, yes. You know, some of the employees were part-timers, but the majority of them were full-time people. And, you know, that, again, hit a blow to the community for the simple reason that those people spent money here in town. You know, they supported our local businesses, grocery store, fast food restaurants, sit-down restaurants, whatever, whatever. And those jobs are no longer available here in town, as well as the fact that, you know, our local people have had to move out of town, some of them for the absolute first time in their entire lives.
I was just going to ask where the residents went.
Some went to a sister facility in Clinton. Some went to the McLean County Nursing Home. Some went to Heritage in Bloomington. You know, everybody was placed. But it's got to be trauma for somebody who has been a resident at one facility for any number of years. Some of these people had been there 10, 15 years, to have to suddenly pack up and move away from your comfortable confines.
Oh, where you spent your whole life. Sure.
Yes, exactly.
Jerry, what happens when we think about, as you've been reporting about, this, not just as we're talking about Leroy Manor in the town of Leroy, but all these other towns, what happens to residents when a nursing home closes? Where do they end up going?
It all depends. They get placed, when a nursing home closes, they have to file 3 months in advance with the state, I think the Department of Public Health, to give these people the opportunities to relocate. And they go to unfamiliar surroundings, neighboring towns, sometimes, you know, it's 20 miles, 30 miles, 40 miles. So it all depends on what's best for them and what has availability.
Jerry, can I ask you also, when we're thinking about reimbursement rates and that being one of the fundamental problems, I can't imagine that the budget impasse that lasted for 2 years helped. What did you see in your reporting from how nursing homes handled that, and if that was also a tough thing that perhaps some facilities are still trying to recover from?
Yeah, so not only were they being reimbursed at decades-old rates, but there was a major funding cut in 2015 that was just a temporary cut. I think Pat said it was 3 months, but she said it set them back, set many homes back so far, and they had to take out bridge loans just to make payroll. That they're still recovering from that, just because they didn't have the revenue to pay their employees at times.
So, Mayor Dean, when we're thinking about Leroy Manor closing this year, I wonder how you're feeling about things now.
Well, we're optimistic. You know, we keep trying to come up with somebody who's interested in doing something with the facility, either reopening it as a nursing home, turning it into an extended care facility of some sort. You know, we want to see the building used. It's a beautiful building. We want to see the building used, and we want to be able to provide local residency for our people who just can't maintain their homes any longer.
And I wanted to ask you, Mayor Dean, and Pat, I would love to have you answer after Mayor Dean. When we're thinking about our aging population, not just across the country, but of course here in Illinois, I believe we've seen some numbers that say our elderly population will triple in the next three decades. Obviously, this isn't a problem that's going away. Mayor Dean, what would you like to see going forward here to try to help towns like your town, all of these other places we're seeing across Illinois with these facilities closing?
Well, reimbursements have to change. You know, these are private businesses, and you can't expect private businesses to operate years on end at a loss before they just simply decide they can't operate anymore. And, you know, to me, it's really important that we get something here for a very selfish reason. I'm 70 years old. You know, I'm in my house, and everything is great. But who's to say what's going to happen in 5 years, 2 years, tomorrow? You know, so selfishly, I want to stay in Leroy.
I mean, I'm sure that lots of folks listening to you completely understand that and feel the same way. Pat, how do you, I mean, apart from the Medicaid reimbursement rate, that sounds like a big thing that you all are trying to tackle. What else would you like to see happen here?
Well, the mayor couldn't have said it better in terms of the priority that the state of Illinois needs to give to the services of these elderly in nursing homes. You know, they fought for our freedom. They've paid their taxes. They've simply outused their resources to become Medicaid qualified. And the state of Illinois simply has to find a way to provide the needed services, because as you so appropriately said, in 20 years, we start seeing the influx of the baby boomers, and we simply need to have the availability of these services in the communities where people live. And that's the tragedy of all this. We're starting to see those local nursing homes, like the one the mayor talked about in Leroy, being in jeopardy. And the state of Illinois simply has to resolve the insolvency issues associated with where we've gotten ourselves.
But problems with your line there, so I think we lost you. But Jerry, can I just ask, we just have about a minute left, and Jerry Nowicki is with us. He's a reporter with Capital News Illinois, joining us from the State House. Jerry, are we hearing, is this on any lawmaker agendas? Is this a legislative priority for lawmakers right now?
There's a whole lot of things that need to happen to get a budget this year, but Governor Pritzker, his budget proposal does include, I think it's estimated $390 million on a basically a tax on Medicaid managed care organizations. So that money would bring a whole lot more money into the system and allow for greater federal matches, and that could conceivably go to nursing homes and skilled care homes.
That's Jerry Nowicki with Capital News Illinois. I want to thank Pat Comstock for being with us, Executive Director of the Healthcare Council of Illinois. And, of course, Mayor of Leroy, Illinois, thank you all for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Sorry, we were having a little technical difficulties here this morning. Earlier this hour, we mentioned the news reported by WBEZ that Governor J.B. Pritzker, First Lady M.K. Pritzker, and his brother-in-law, Thomas Munster, are being investigated by federal law enforcement authorities. Authorities are looking into a property tax break of more than $331,000 that the Pritzkers received on a Gold Coast mansion. Governor Pritzker actually held a news conference earlier this morning and answered questions from reporters about this investigation. I think we have some of that audio. Here's what he had to say.
Well, let me be clear that I'm very confident that any review of this matter will show that all the rules were followed. I have not been contacted by any law enforcement, neither has MK. I will say that last October, my opponents raised this issue, and it became a political subject last October. But today, we're very focused on the important work that needs to get done in Springfield.
Nyla, you're back.
Thanks to ABC7 Chicago for that audio. The governor also said he has, quote, no concerns at all about criminal charges stemming from this investigation, and that he was first made aware of the investigation when WBEZ called for comment. If you're listening to this program while you're driving, we hope you're staying alert and keeping your eyes on the road, especially if you see a state patrol car with its emergency lights flashing. The law says that when that happens, you're supposed to slow down and move over when it's safe. This year, though, there's been a big spike in the number of drivers who've actually hit squad cars. There were 8 all of last year, but there's been 17 since January 1st of this year. And sadly, we've already seen 3 state troopers who've lost their lives. Illinois State Police now say they're stepping up enforcement and also trying to get the word out. For more on that, I'm joined by Christopher Watson, an Illinois State Police sergeant and public information officer. Sergeant Watson, welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Sergeant Watson, I can't imagine how difficult this must be for you to talk about, knowing that you've had colleagues who have lost their lives this way. And so I just wanted to start by telling you how sorry I am for your loss.
Thank you very much for your concern. We truly appreciate that. But honestly, we're trying to use the strife that our agency has experienced with these 16 crashes to push the message out to the public. You know, yes, this has happened bad to us, but we're hoping that this message will benefit all, because Scott's Law actually covers a variety of different people, and one of those people is the public. It covers police, fire, EMS, construction, tow truck drivers, and if you, on your way home from the studio this afternoon, break down on the side of the road, activate your four-way flashers, and the law will then apply to you as well.
And so I wonder, when we're thinking about this, as I mentioned, there were just 8 crashes last year when we're thinking about state patrol cars, and now we're just at April and we're at more than double of that number. Is there any reason, do you know if we have any reason why? I wonder if these crashes have anything in common. I know in one case, the weather was pretty bad. It was during a snowstorm.
That's a great question. So when we look at the breakdown of the crashes, 28% of them involved driving under the influence. 28% included exceeding safe speed for the condition. So that would be your snow-related type crashes. 36% were including failure to reduce speed to avoid a crash. 28% were some sort of lane usage. 4 of the crashes involved commercial motor vehicles. So there's really no consistent one cause that is contributing to this. Obviously, we all know that distractions are a huge issue on our roadways. So the state police is looking at this more as a choices issue. There's not one bad thing that people are doing wrong. It's kind of a perfect storm. And so we're attacking it from that choices standpoint. When you drive down the roadway, there are a multitude of choices that we as drivers make. Some of those choices involve breaking the law. Some of those choices involve not breaking the law, but they're still poor choices within your vehicle. Some of those things might be changing the radio station because you don't like what's playing, or changing, or going and eating a sandwich. Those things are not illegal, but they're still poor choices. And so that's why we're looking at it from this standpoint, is encouraging drivers to make better choices while they're behind the wheel.
And Sergeant Watson, I wonder how much of us also is, I mean, we've heard so much about distracted driving, people not paying attention, people on their phones. I mean, I just wonder how much people maybe also might miss, like seeing someone pulled over on the side with their blinkers on. Do you think that might be part of the equation as well, just getting folks to pay full attention?
I mean, you think about it. When was the last time you had any sort of driver's training? Probably back when you were in high school, right?
Yeah, a long time ago.
15, 60, yeah, right? Same for me. So, you know, you think back the last time that you had driver's training, they were telling you, look 12 seconds down the road, minimum. It's hard to look 12 seconds down the road when you're focused on your screen or you're focused on the barbecue sandwich that's spilling down your tire dress. So, you know, we have a ton of distractions in our vehicles nowadays. And again, that's kind of why we're looking at it from the choices perspective, is what choice are you making in your vehicle today that can positively impact the safety of not only yourself, but other roadway users? Because that's my office. That's a tow truck driver's world. That's a firefighter's world. When they're on the shoulder, that is where they work. Think about the radio station. Would you like somebody running 70 miles an hour down the hallway right outside of your studio door? It's kind of startling, isn't it? So from our perspective, give us that break. You know, move over away from our traffic stop. And if you can't, we understand. Things happen. Semis hem you in. Other vehicles get you to where you can't move over into that other lane. Oncoming traffic on a two-lane. It's understandable. Slow down. As you pass us, give us a break. You know, we're suggesting 20 mile an hour below the speed limit, because we all know that when you hit something, the faster you're going, the more it's going to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're slowing down, it gives us a better chance to survive that situation if something does go wrong.
So, Sergeant, we're thinking about 12 seconds ahead of you, slowing down also when you're pulling over. I mentioned ISP is stepping up enforcement of the law that requires drivers to slow down. What does that mean in practice for you guys?
So, to put it in perspective, the total citations written for move over violations in January through December of 2018 was 881 statewide. To compare apples to apples, January 1 of 2018 to April 23, so yesterday's date, so we get a complete date. I can't run it for today because the day's not over. There were 281 written in that time frame from January 1 to today's date in 2018. So to compare that to this year, we've already written 1,845 Scotts Hall traffic citations. So we've doubled down just in the first 3 months of last year's entire activity. But here's the thing that we want to stress. It's not about tickets. We would rather have this conversation with you and the listeners in the studio and in an educational setting versus having that conversation on the side of the road. We would much rather have it here because it's saving them money. It's not putting us at risk. It doesn't involve court dates and fines and all the other damage to your driver's record and insurance. So we would rather have that in an educational setting through you and through the school systems that we're already involved in versus having that conversation on the side of the road. Save your money.
And it also, obviously, we're saving people's lives here. It's pretty straightforward for everyone to just pay attention and move over. Yeah. Sergeant Christopher Watson is deputy chief with Illinois State Police. He's also a PIO, a public information officer. Sergeant, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Thank you.
I truly appreciate you reaching out. Thank you, and I hope you have a great day.
Once upon a time, bison roamed all throughout Illinois. It was part of millions of bison that used to roam all across the U.S., but by the end of the 19th century, they were nearly extinct. Since that time, the American bison population has been steadily growing again thanks to the work of organizations throughout the U.S., and one of those is Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory right here in Illinois. Up to 30 bison roam on their 1,100-acre prairie outside of Batavia at a time. Every year, Fermi Lab adds to their brood. The first calf of the year was just born this past weekend, which means baby bison season is officially upon us. Andre Salas is on the line with us now from Fermi Lab, where he's in their office of communication. Hi, Andre. Welcome to the 21st. Thank you for joining us.
Well, hello. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Andre, we wanted to talk more about the baby bison, but first, I wonder if you can tell us how bison came to be at Fermi Lab in the first place?
Sure, no problem. So our original director was a man named Robert Wilson, and he was from Wyoming. And when he came to Fermilab, he designed the site basically to remind him of the frontier, but also to be a metaphor for our scientists, to remind them they're supposed to be on the frontiers of research. So bison are frontier animals, and he wanted them here to remind him of home. So he brought a herd of bison starting in 1969. The herd was at one time up to about 100 bison, and we keep it about 28 to 30 right now.
And why is that? Is that just for size and because of the acreage?
Yeah, well, it's because we don't have the money to keep people to maintain a herd that large. So we keep it about 28 or 30 now.
But I guess it sounds like you do have people who are maintaining the herd, or people who, it's kind of their job at Fermilab to take care of the bison.
That's right. We have a herdsman. His name is Cleo Garcia. He's been here quite some time, and he gets support from the Roads and Grounds group here.
And, I mean, although we're talking about how bison were obviously once native to the Midwest, I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners have never seen a bison in person, and I wonder how big do the bison get that you guys have in Batavia?
Oh, they're pretty large. Yeah. So every time there's a new baby bison born, every time the bison season starts, I actually get to go out in the truck with reporters to see the new babies, and we get up pretty close. And up close, they are massive, majestic animals. They are they're furry. They come above the cab of the truck. They're that large. And they're a little scary, but they're also really really impressive to look at.
And so the first calf was born this past weekend. How many calves are you guys expecting this year?
So it depends. It usually depends year to year on how many females we have. This year we have 14, so we're expecting up to 14.
And I imagine this is a fun time of year for you guys to be able to see those babies out there.
Oh, it's terrific! Yeah, so the bison are here mainly to be a public attraction. The public absolutely loves them, and the news that the first baby bison is born every year is one of the most popular press releases that we put out. People come from far and wide to come see the adorable babies. They're very small. They're sort of a lighter brown, and they're incredibly cute. So. The laboratory is open every day to the public, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. All you need is a photo ID, like a driver's license, to get on site. And the entire area around the bison pasture is open to the public, so people can come in and see them whenever the lab is open. And they do by the thousands.
And people are having lots of fun on social media as well with the pictures and naming the bison. I think our staff favorite for the 21st is someone who suggested Neil deGrasse Bison for one of the baby names. I guess you probably don't name them, though, right?
We do not. No. Occasionally on Twitter, we will pretend to name them. We'll have a contest to pretend to name them. But no, the bison just get numbers.
All right. Well, if you are in the Batavia area, you can go and see the bison at Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. I want to thank Andre Salas, one of their spokespersons, for being with us. Andre, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That does it for us today. Our Twitter handle, by the way, is 21STShow. We were tweeting pictures of that baby bison. If you want to see that, we should post them on our Facebook page, too, where you can search for us to like us. It's a good way to message us or ask if you have questions you want to ask us, you can always get in touch with us on Facebook. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, just go to our website as well. That's 21stShow.org. that's a good place to find past shows and has all of our contact information. We're also available on iTunes, Spotify, Android, most places where you get your podcasts. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.